Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Modiwa Gavaza, and for today, I am in Cape Town. I am in the Media 24 building, and I am at Naspers' head office. And for today, we're going to be chatting with the team just around their results. That is for the full 2024 financial year. It's a big one for the group. It's the year that they have reached profitability in their e-commerce businesses, and you know, some people would say their business is extensive, but you know, we're going to be having that conversation with Irvin Tu, who is the president and chief investment officer for Naspers Process, and get a sense of the lay of the land. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Mandiyu. It's a real pleasure to be here.
I think a good place for us to start, there's so many things to talk about in the universe of the Naspers and Process, but where I want us to locate this discussion is that you joined Naspers a couple of years ago, you know, coming out from, you know, some of the big tech investors in the world, the likes of SoftBank. Where you are now, how do you think Naspers and Process are located in the global universe? We often talk about, you know, you guys being a top 10 investor in terms of tech globally and all that.
So I joined almost 3 years ago now, and I was at SoftBank previously for 5 years. I was part of the team that created a vision fund, and I led some larger investments in companies like Uber and ByteDance and others. And I have that perspective from those 5 years. Today, what I can share with you about us, Process and Naspers, is we are extremely well situated. We sit here having made the transition from a growth perspective, how we manage our businesses, to a profitable growth perspective. You can see that our results today. You've mentioned it already. And what that enables us to do is redeploy investment that would otherwise go into our loss-making businesses elsewhere, right? So not to say that we won't invest in ourselves as well. We will. Our current ecosystem and set of businesses will be a huge area and priority for our investment. Yeah. At the same time, we no longer have the burden of enormous losses. We've improved our trading profit by 451 million over the last year. Our cash flow improved by 773 million. So lots of good things in this year's results, and it only positions us better for the future. By the way, we also have a very healthy balance sheet, so we can deploy cash where we find productive use.
With everything that's actually happening, and I'm glad that, you know, you've been with the business for about the 3 years that you spoke about now. I wanted us to maybe take an inside and then outside approach. And when I say inside, I mean South Africa, and then, you know, go out into the world, because you guys are a global facing business, but, you know, still hugely important in the SA market. And one of the big pieces, as I said, we are in the Media 24 building. There's been a lot of, you know, chatter around, you know, Media 24, you know, closing of some of the print titles, that type of thing. And that's a business that's actually, at least my understanding, also, you know, in the world of profitability. Maybe you could just talk to us around, you know, some of the developments in that space, because I think globally we have been seeing this huge shift towards digital. But for, you know, I guess the South African market, there's still, you know, that wrangling, that emotional piece to some of the biggest titles, you know, in the country.
Let me start by saying South Africa is enormously important to us. We understand it's our heritage. We understand we have a lot of people here, and our importance to the country, we understand. So really a priority for us as a group. And Media 24 is also important to the media landscape here. It's the most important player in that regard. What we've experienced here at Media 24, what we announced last week is a consequence of the changes and transition we've seen, as you alluded to, throughout the world, the transition from print to digital.
Yeah.
And we are investing behind that transition. Mm-hmm. And the content still exists and we still have readership. It's just that content's moving online and the readership has moved online. We're following the readers.
Yeah.
So now those transitions can be challenging and difficult and involve people. And we acknowledge that and we don't take these decisions lightly. But Median 24 continues to be very important to the country. It's important to us, and we will continue to invest behind it. It is a profitable business. You're right. That's not the its only importance in our group. It's far more important than just its mere financial performance.
When it comes to something like that, your view, especially from a global point of view, because when we look at the big tech companies globally, a couple of them will have, you know, media assets in their stable. I'm talking Amazon, Netflix, Facebook, mm-hmm. Apple. You know, they all have a media presence of some sort. Is that an area of potential expansion, or are you okay locating it as it is, as probably a purely South African play?
Well, content businesses, you're right, have been growth extensions to some of these overall huge tech players like an Apple, and Netflix, of course, was originally just distribution of content via DVDs and then became subscription. Then they had their own in-house production team, which has been one of the reasons they've been so successful. Content is incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
And to do it well requires a lot of expertise and experience and the right team and people. So I wouldn't anticipate that content is something that we, as a primary matter, invest behind at this moment. Never say never, because as we become bigger and more successful, let's hope we will. There may be other avenues to explore content-related businesses. But, you know, one of the brilliant parts of the ByteDance, or Douyin in China, otherwise known as TikTok phenomenon, is its user-generated content. Yes. They don't have content development costs. Mm. And yet it's content, right? And it's absolutely enthralling, engaging consumers, audience everywhere, but they don't have the burden of content development. So it's a brilliant model. Gee, I wish we had found that at Prosys and Aspers when I was at SoftBank. I invested behind it because I invested in ByteDance. Once those businesses take off and create their own scale and audience, it's very difficult to disrupt them further, and they will continue to disrupt the incumbents. Okay. Now, we have Tencent, and that's in China. They have that too. They have short videos. They have Tencent Video, long form content. Games, of course, is a form of content. We have a lot of content if you think about the stable, including Tencent. It's primarily China, though. They have some international games as well. So we do have it. It's not something, though, I would envision our going into further outside of China beyond Tencent at this time.
And it makes sense because I guess Tencent, especially as the biggest gaming company in the world, it is a behemoth.
It's an incredibly successful company. It also has all these other elements of the ecosystem, though, which ties people together, you know, frequency of using the ecosystem. Yeah, so there are a lot of benefits to content in that ecosystem.
Yeah.
You can't just say build a content business, yeah, for it to be successful.
So now looking at the, I guess, the portfolio that you guys have, you guys are invested across the likes of e-tail, classifieds, you know, food, fintech, and edtech, right? What went right? Because your profitability is, you know, to use your language, is in aggregate, right? Which means that you've got classifieds and you've got e-tail that have done well, and those are in the black. And then you've still got edtech and I think fintech that are in the red. But overall, the portfolio is profitable. What went well on the classifieds side? You know, because I think that was the one that registered the best growth. And perhaps, you know, conversely, what's gone the opposite, you know, the worst performer, which is education.
Yeah. No portfolio is equal weight. Yeah. No portfolio performs equally across the board in all elements. So too with our portfolio. And classifieds, you highlight, has done really well this past year, 27% growth, 24% TP margin. And that's because of a few elements. Our motors vertical has done exceptionally well as we continue to add additional products and services to the professional dealer customer base, because our verticals are generally domains for professionals as opposed to ordinary consumers.
Yeah.
And you can see that in some of the data we shared in our slides today, that we create a lot of value together, both for us and for them. So classifieds and its outperformance is a function of strength in motors, is a function of recovery in Ukraine, and other elements, strength also in real estate. So we've done well in the verticals, and there's been a Ukraine recovery. That's classifieds. The other standout performer is iFood. So iFood in the core food delivery business actually grew well, over 20%, but also produced 24% trading profit margin. The core food delivery, overall iFood was lower, single digits trading profit margin, because it's investing behind new initiatives. The core food delivery business, though, 24% margin, that's best in class worldwide. Okay, so those two are the big standout performers. When you ask why did the portfolio overall in aggregate do well, those two really led the way, and they're larger businesses. iFood is a $1.2 billion top line business. Our classifieds, OLX, and our classifieds business is a 600-ish million top line business. So those two led the way. Now, in terms of the other side of the portfolio, yes, the edtech sector for us has not done as well.
Yeah.
We've made a lot of improvements. So I want to acknowledge that we've been working very hard, and we took some significant cost action with some of our businesses. And we've also improved their products, and we've improved engagement with consumers, and their financial performance actually has improved measurably, but it's still nowhere near where we need it to be.
Yeah.
So that's what I'd say on edtech. And you know, we've invested roughly $3.9 billion into edtech. $3 billion of that 3.9 went to three businesses in particular where we haven't seen the right performance. Those businesses are Stack Overflow, Skillsoft, which is a minority investment, publicly traded company in the US, and also Byju's, which you may have seen we wrote down to a zero in this financial year.
So it's actually quite a tough one. But as you said, there have been a lot of cyclical trends that have led education to be where they are. We've seen a lot of valuations coming down in the edtech sector across the world. Even I think locally, some of the businesses that had been doing well, you know, on the, what you call this, on the edtech front, you know, have found themselves there. One of the things I'm most curious about is, now that you have the portfolio the way that it is, we've sort of located it, someone who's listening sort of has a picture, is going forward, right? How do you create an ecosystem, right, from your businesses? And I ask that because one of your big focuses now is AI, right? And if you were Amazon, Apple, Google, you know, you are owner operator, and you've got all of these different properties, and you can literally just tell them what to do. Guys, this is where we're going. But when you have a mix, you know, of the owned properties and, you know, associate properties, how do you develop, you know, a viable ecosystem between the different businesses?
So the definition of ecosystem is really important to first discuss. Now, we have, its most common usage, I think, is when you have a common customer and you sell to that common customer a number of different products and services that your ecosystem contains.
Apple
is a great example. Tencent's a great example. There are many examples. Yeah. We do that in our individual businesses. We talked about OLX earlier. Of course, we should also mention iFood. That's the prospect. We should talk about eMAG in our e-tail sector in Romania. They do that extremely well, not just e-commerce, but also food, but also grocery, but also logistics and delivery. There's a bunch of stuff in their ecosystem.
Yeah.
It may actually be the strongest ecosystem play we have in our whole portfolio. Then, if you talk about what an ecosystem means at the group level in a holding company context, you have to change the definition. It's not about a common customer because, of course, there is no common customer.
Yeah.
An iFood customer is not not an eMAG customer by definition. One's in Brazil, one's in Romania or Bulgaria or Hungary. The ecosystem then has to be expressed differently. And the way we think about it is it's expressed by commonality of approach, management system, and something that you'll hear Fabrizio, who's coming as our appointed CEO. He uses that word a lot, management system. It's about best practice, knowledge sharing. It's about AI, you mentioned AI, and how we can nudge and deploy AI across the entirety of the portfolio because it will help their businesses. We can add to their business success by introducing AI concepts, by deploying our central team to help them develop products. And we're actually deploying that with some of our portfolio companies now. I won't give you specifics yet, but we are working on pilot projects to really embed the AI capability and also innovate with new products and services at a few of our companies. That's being driven, led by our central team. So the ecosystem definition changes when we talk about the holding company group level versus at the operating business level.
Would I be going too far to say that at least what I'm hearing from you is that a company, you know, at the level of process sort of becomes either a manager of ecosystems or an ecosystem of ecosystems?
I'm going to borrow that, Madiwa. that's a well-phrased summary of what we were trying to affect, what we're trying to accomplish. So the idea is not a new idea. It's been tried before. I'll mention SoftBank. When I was at SoftBank, that was also an approach. We were at the time trying to, if we were investing in a company in the US, well, we can open doors in Europe, we can open doors in Japan, and so forth. Or one of our big operating businesses at the time could use some of the products and services of the investment portfolio. So it's that's one level, which is the commercial connectivity between the businesses. We will, of course, also promote that. We're taking another step, though, here at Prosys. We're taking it maybe two or three steps beyond, which is to try to disseminate benefit through our management system, through our culture, values, through our AI understanding and expertise, through incentives and so forth. So there's knowledge sharing, best practices. We're actually going to try to do it and not just talk about it.
It is, yeah, that is actually quite an approach because I think what are typically viewed as holding companies, you know,
they don't tend to do this.
Yes.
Yeah, they don't tend to do this. Every company is different, and some holding companies are more successful than others. So I don't think there's one recipe that is the quote unquote right recipe. This is the recipe that we think will work with what we have.
So when it comes to going forward now, because we're still on the AI trend and theme, is the fact that AI has done a lot, at least in my view, to inflate a lot of valuations, right? You know, maybe I'm being, you know, wrong here, but it just feels like it's a bit much sometimes. But what I wanted to gauge from you, especially as someone who probably has a lot of deals coming across your desk on a daily basis, is how do you not let the AI piece, I guess, inflate, you know, the possible valuation of something that you're looking at? Because right now, you know, all one needs to do is to look at NVIDIA, look at what happened to, let's say, Apple stock the day that they announced Apple Intelligence, you know, to just see how much fervor there is in the market around this type of thing.
So there's no panacea. There's no perfect solution. We are also price takers in the market. And if we feel like the business is a great business, but it's overpriced, the only thing we can do is say no. We can't prevent valuation uplift, right? Because that's a reflection of the market. That's a reflection of what other investors are prepared to do. And that's hard. Let me just say to you, not participating in exciting stuff is hard because there's FOMO. We've all lived FOMO. It was as recent as 3 years ago in 2021. And we have to be careful in our processes and our incentives, which we've changed, so that we try to prevent the worst of FOMO from afflicting us. And so that's what I'd say. But second, all you can do is say no and watch for other opportunities. We happen to think most of the valuation uplift that's happening in AI is driven by the Magnificent Seven stuff and their related investments, because each of them is investing in the likes of OpenAI and Anthropic and so forth, right? Mistral, and you can see it, Hugging Face. So now they're doing so, they're investing behind it because they also get ancillary revenue. They have hyperscaler cloud revenue since there's so much compute capacity that's required from these LLMs that they say, oh, well, we become a customer too.
Yeah.
So they get side benefits that many don't get. We happen to think that there are many other investable opportunities out there. We are still extremely early and we will benefit from those. This is like, just to draw an analogy, you know, in the internet, Netscape Navigator was 1994, right? And the internet, when did the real boom happen? It was probably several years later. And yes, we all remember how it ended, but there was a time when let's not even take the late 90s. Let's think about internet value creation since. Yeah. There's been an enormous amount of value creation that occurred in the 25 years.
Yeah.
And maybe even 30 years. So we should think about it on those terms. We're like in 1995 right now, if you want to think about where we sit in this AI, in this Gen AI thing.
And when it comes to that, I think before we land this conversation, it's two things. The first one is, you know, on that AI theme and valuations, is a lot of us are expecting that the US Fed is going to start cutting rates soon. And
well, the dot plot says so.
It
will.
And when interest rates come down, we typically see, you know, a cycle, you know, that sees valuations, you know, coming back up, despite what you call this, the drop in valuations over the last couple of years, the market tends to get excited. So what I'm afraid of personally is that you've got AI as a hype cycle, and soon you're going to have cheap capital coming into the market. Maybe you could talk to us about that.
Well, markets are forward-looking. So valuations today already build in the expectation of the rate cuts. That's one. It's an important statement. Mm-hmm. And so because this expectation of rate cutting has been there for a long time now. Number two, I would say that whether cheap money will again come into the system and cause further valuation uplift, there's actually a ton of money already sitting on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. They could deploy now. They don't need low interest rates to deploy. There's a bunch of capital sitting there looking for good opportunities, just as we are. So it's competitive. What I've just described, I'm not saying it's easy, Madhiva, to invest behind this next wave and not do the things that the Big Seven, the Magnificent Seven are doing. There's lots of opportunity there. Still, we have to choose properly. We have to discuss properly and make good investments, right? So that's what I'd say.
Okay. And then I think, you know, finally, in the last minute or so, this is something that I've been curious about for a long time, and it's great that we have a CIO to give us a view on this. Are you a person who invests in a person, or are you a person who invests in a business model and idea, because it seems that different investors tend to have a different view on that. We can see this person is going to go far, but their business is wonky, or we can see their business is going to go far, but the founder, we're not so sure about him. So where do you, how do you think about
this? This concept is inseparable. You portray it as two distinct concepts, but it's inseparable. This is like yin and yang, right? There's the white and the black, but within the black, there's a little bit of white, that little white circle. Within the white, there's a little bit of black, that little black circle. That's this topic you're raising. They're not separable. Without the fantastic management team, entrepreneur, founder, CEO, that beautiful business model won't be properly executed. Without that great business, you can put an incredible person in front of a poor business. They can only do so much. So you can put the best manager in the world in front of this print media thing that's been translated to digital media. You're not going to save a physical newspaper. Look at Jeff Bezos. He bought the Washington Post. And yeah, there are many examples of this. So this is an inseparable thing. I wouldn't portray it so distinctly. We have to think about both.
So that's where we end off. It has been a really great discussion just talking to Irvin Tu, who is our president and chief investment officer over at Naspers and Process, giving us some insight into their 2024 financial results up to earlier this year, it should be March. And I think the two big key takeaways is the fact that we cannot escape some of the cyclical trends that are happening in the market. I think, some of the stuff that we're seeing in the media space, is proof of that. And, one does have to, give credit where it's due. If you do have a media business that has been able to find profitability in this environment, particularly in an online space, where people are still figuring that out, you do have to take that. And then secondly, great to hear some of the thoughts, from Irvin around valuations, particularly as they pertain to the global markets, interest rates, and AI. There's a lot that's being said about all of those key things, but one of the big things that he says is the fact that as long as you have, good teams, good managers behind it, and enough capital, of course, you might have some steam in the system, but that is just how these markets work. So that's where we end off. Irvin, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much. Fun to be here.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcast on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. I've been Mudiyo Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So from myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.